like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Dr. David M. Pena Guzman, an assistant professor at San Francisco State University. Pena Guzman, who works in such areas as the history and philosophy of science and animal studies, wrote a scholarly paper for the journal Animal Sentience in which he addressed the question of whether non-human animals can commit suicide. In answering that question, he methodically lays out the criteria that's considered necessary for suicidal behavior, cites various studies, and that part of the Oscar-winning documentary The Cove, where Rickle Berry recalls the dolphin, who apparently killed herself by willingly choosing not to breathe, and assorted other relevant phenomena. We'll discuss this paper and the conclusion he arrived at when we speak with Dr. David M. Pena Guzman in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll play back the interview I recorded Monday with Selena Schultz, who over the last 5 years has published 3 books about animal shelters, fostering, and adoption. She's donated more than $5,000 in proceeds from the book sales to an array of shelters and created an organization designed to encourage others to donate to shelters and volunteer at them. What may make this string of accomplishments particularly notable is that Selena Schultz is 13 years old. Also, I want to recognize the passing of Doris Day, who famously was, among her many other talents and accomplishments, a longtime animal welfare activist. In the first few years of this show, I invited her to be a guest on the program, and each time I received a very warm note back, politely declining the invitation. I eventually stopped sending those invitations, but never stopped hoping an interview with her would somehow work out. She did amazing, obviously, work for many, many, many years on behalf of animals. Rest in peace, Doris Day. Lastly, in advance of WMNF's Summer Fun Drive taking place in just a few weeks, I have a pair of tickets for a pledge of $70 to see Cat Power performing at the Ritz Ebor on September 13th. If you're interested in pledging for these tickets, send an email to me here during the show at dj@wmnf.org. If you want to just support Talking Animals and the work that we do, and you're maybe less concerned about concert tickets, you can arrange a pledge by also emailing dj@wmnf.org or just hitting the Talking Animals tip jar with whatever donation you can. You can find that, of course, online at wmnf.org under the Talking Animals part of the schedule. Right now, though, let's get to Dr. Pena Guzman with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Emailing dj@wmnf.org or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. David M. Pena Guzman on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Pena Guzman.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. I know it's early out there in San Francisco, so I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, and it's only 7 a.m., so not a bad time to start the day.
Okay, well, there you go. That's the kind of attitude we like. So, of course, we'll explore the paper in a moment, but let's first learn a bit about you and trace some of the path that may have led to your writing this piece. Now, if we look at your CV, at least a cursory look, I'm not sure we'd see much that telegraphs the animal interest. By training, if not inclination, you're a philosopher. So, where does the animal part of your narrative first surface? What role, for example, did animals play when you were a kid?
Well, actually, animals played a relatively small role in my childhood, which puts me in the minority when it comes to people who work in animal studies, animal ethics, animal behavior, animal cognition.
Yeah.
And I first began thinking about animals more rigorously in graduate school when I was exposed to new trends within philosophy, and as you pointed out, by training, I'm a professional philosopher. And it turns out that in philosophy, animals are raising a number of questions about classical concepts that we used to think about human experience experience, language, rationality, morality. Depending on how you look at those concepts, certain non-human animals may fall within their domain or outside of their domain. And as I realized that the animal sciences were putting pressure on these key philosophical concepts, I began thinking about animals more regularly and more systematically. And now they are part of my research. They are what I study.
So it sounds like, just to backtrack a little bit from there, Dr. Pena Guzman, so growing up, were animals just not part of the household, part of the family? Were that was there just not kind of any direct experience with animals in those years?
That's correct. I experienced animals, I think, in the way the vast majority of people do, at the dinner table, but not in any personal or emotional or extended way. I grew up in a Mexican family, and my grandfather had a ranch to which we would sometimes go, but I never really interacted with animals in any kind of protracted way. So animals were always somewhat distant. And in fact, my grandmother, with whom I lived growing up, had an embargo on animals in the house. So we weren't allowed to have any animals nearby.
So what prompted that embargo?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I think my grandmother had a sense that animals don't belong in the house. They belong either in nature or in the farm or in an open space. And I think she just personally didn't like them very much.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that as a child, my interactions with animals were really limited.
Yeah.
Really to either the stray dogs that I encountered at the public park or on the street, or occasionally the pets that some of my friends would have.
So really, your interest in animals is, in the most literal sense possible, truly academic. And now, as an adult on your own, a professor, et cetera, do you have any animal or animals that live with you currently?
No. So as you mentioned, I live in San Francisco, where there's a housing crisis.
Yeah.
And, most places that are rented have rules that prevent the having of pets. So for example, I live in an apartment where pets are simply not allowed. And so that has continued that I don't have animals on the day to day. But I do work on them regularly, as I mentioned. And so I think it's not unfair to say that my interest in animals is academic, although as a result of my academic work, my own personal orientation towards animals has, of course, shifted, because you cannot work in the fields of animal behavior and animal cognition without, to some degree, undergoing a kind of shift in terms of your relationship to animals and your view of animals.
Yeah.
So,
oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I would say that it's exclusively academic.
That was just so I could work in that pun, really, basically. But more to the point, and more seriously, I often ask those kind of questions of the guests, because whether they're working in animal welfare issues, they're authors, whatever the case might be, you really, I've learned, can't predict. Some people grew up with animals. Animals were a big part of their formative years, their family life, really important, and therefore familiarity and attitudes that were shaped that way. And some people, they had an embargo, apparently, not unlike your grandmother imposed, so they had no animal interaction, and in some cases clearly have, whether they would acknowledge it initially or not, or were conscious of it initially or not, have reacted against that and surrounded with animals and work in their day-to-day job and all their other free time with animals. So it's just always interesting to kind of get a little bit of a measure of that, and especially, again, with some of the things that you teach at the university and obviously the paper that we're here chiefly to discuss. It's just interesting to have context for that. This is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is Talking Animals on WNF. More specifically, if you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. David Pena Guzman, an assistant professor at San Francisco State University. We'll primarily be discussing a scholarly paper he wrote for the journal Animal Sentience, in which he addresses the question of whether animals can commit suicide. If you'd like to ask Dr. Pena Guzman a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Dr. Pena Guzman, what was the impetus for the paper exploring the concept of animal suicide? Were you working on something else or thinking about something else at the time when this occurred to you, or how did it first come along?
Well, about 2 years ago, I was doing a postdoc in Canada where I was working at a center that specializes on evolutionary biology and conservation ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began doing research more full-time in connection to animals, nature, and the environment. In that setting, and I think it was in 2016, I was invited to give a talk at the Canadian Society for Bioethics. A colleague of mine from Halifax was putting together an academic panel for a conference about the subject of animal denial or animal negation. I think the term they used was animal resistance. And the question motivating the creation of that panel was relatively straightforward. Can animals refute human-created experimental settings? Can they reject certain conditions that are proposed to them by humans? Now, in that context, I began thinking about what animal refusal might entail. And of course, as a philosopher, and this is where you see the background sort of coming through, I started asking myself, well, what's the highest form of refusal or negation that we can think about in the case of human beings? And it seems as if suicide might be the highest form of rejection. And so I began to do research, and much to my surprise, there is a small but available scholarly literature, a scientific literature on the subject of animal suicide, dating from mostly the 1970s and 1980s. And so I began moving my way through some of the scientific articles that talk about animal behavior in the context of suicide, some of the research from the field of suicide studies, and I realized that there is an interaction between these two bodies of literature, research on animal behavior and research on suicide. And what I do in the paper is I put them together and make this argument that is rooted in what I call the animal suicide hypothesis, which is very simply the notion that suicide is a continuum that cuts across various species.
We'll sort of, I guess, in a way, come back around to that because, I mean, the piece itself is ambitious, is kind of dense and heavily sourced and meticulously footnoted, I guess about 24 pages if you include all the sources and footnotes and references. So I'm going to guess that probably at this point, very few folks listening have read the article yet, although that could well change after this morning's show. So we can't really get into a hugely detailed discussion in our allotted time here, but I'm going to ask you to walk us through at least some of the broader contours of the piece. For example, what are some traits or abilities considered fundamental when we contemplate whether a being, an animal or a non-human animal, could indeed contemplate suicide?
Well, that's the thing. If you pose that question to suicide experts, you will get a very, very vast number of answers, and they will not always cohere. So it depends on whom you ask. So this is something that I talk about in my piece, that so much of the issue of whether we allow animals inside of this category of suicide, it's actually a definitional issue, and it depends on how you build your definition of suicide. So, for example, there are a number of criteria that are floated in the literature that are quite common, but not universally accepted. So, for instance, typically, suicide experts will say that in order to commit suicide, you need to have a concept of death, because otherwise, the notion of suicide doesn't. Another criterion that is often presented is the theological notion of free will that sometimes sneaks into psychological and scientific research, because we tend to think of suicide as something that people intend, that they choose willingly. And so that's another common standard for thinking about suicide. But there are a number of others.
Mm-hmm.
A third one that I discuss in the paper is what philosophers and scientists sometimes call reflexive subjectivity, which refers to the kind of subjectivity that some organisms have that includes the capacity to reflect upon the self, to have a sense of self, the capacity to say, I am a being and this is my experience. Of course, not linguistically, but it essentially refers to having a first-person standpoint on the world. And so some people have made the argument that if you are not a subject in this sense, a reflexive subject, then you, by definition, wouldn't be able to commit suicide, because suicide is an action in which the subject is both agent and target. So it is a reflexive
act. And so with that part of it in mind, Dr. Pena Guzman, maybe you can address how some would say that children might not be able to meet that requirement, whereas others would, again, as you say, there's an array of opinions and notions from various experts in this field, but some would say that children cannot meet the reflexive subjectivity notion, and some would say, well, they not only can, but they have.
Well, yes, and depending on how you interpret some of the data, we know that there are children as young as 5 and 6 who commit what's called suicide. It's not a very common phenomenon, but it is a recorded phenomenon. When you look at these cases of young children, it seems like they wouldn't meet the condition of reflexive subjectivity. And depending on your interpretation of child psychology, they may not meet the other criteria, which include having a very sophisticated sense of free will and having an awareness of the meaning of the concept of death. Does a 5-year-old child have a developed understanding of death? I'm not sure. And so in the paper, what I do is I point to some of these cases, the case of children, the case of people who are higher on the autism spectrum, whom, again, depending on how you interpret what's going on, may not meet a number of norms. And what I do is use these cases to suggest that some of these criteria are not absolute. And once they are not absolute, it opens the door for having a broader understanding of the kinds of organisms that can potentially engage in self-destructive suicidal behaviors. And in my case, I'm, of course, interested in non-human animals. But once you accept that, for example, children can commit suicide without having reflexive subjectivity, then you cannot consistently say animals cannot commit suicide because they do not have reflexive subjectivity.
Right. So as we see, as the piece unfolds, and I guess this is often the case when there's this kind of subject being pondered, and again, probably not uncommon just in the overall philosophy realm, there's certain things that you can't say yes to definitively, some questions like these, but by the same token, as you lay out here, there's certain things that conversely you can't say no definitively to either, based on research and findings and various experts weighing in.
Correct. And I think this is where the concept that I introduce of epistemic humility is particularly important, because we already, for a number of social and political reasons, have such a low bar or a low expectation of who animals are, what animals can do, that in many ways we're already trying to draw negative conclusions. You know, of course animals do not understand death. Of course animals are not complex subjects like human beings are. And one of the driving forces behind the paper and my work in animals more generally is to say there are some negations that may seem very comfortable to us because of a number of biases that we already carry with us that when you look at the science are not actually supported. So it's a warning against drawing very grandiose negative conclusions about the psychological, behavioral, and emotional capacities of non-human animals.
And again, there's some people, experts that have weighed in on your piece. I don't have it in front of me right now, the passage I'm looking for, but one of those was Dr. Jessica Pierce, and I think at some point she says, and I wish I could find it, but just that sometimes the initial impulse in reacting to something like this is dismiss it, just the very core question, as silly or unreasonable before people delve into the empirical data and other things that you cite to make your case.
Yes, and this is something that those of us who work on animal studies are very familiar with, that knee-jerk reaction that so many people, so many readers, so many audience members may have, especially when we're dealing with categories or concepts that historically we have used to support the idea that humans are unique in the order of nature and that we have some inimical moral or metaphysical status that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And suicide in particular seems to be one of these categories that we tend to think mark a line in the sand between human and non-human animal. And my interest is to say things are a lot more complicated once you actually jump into the literature that shows. And I mean, we have extensive evidence from laboratory studies and from field studies that a wide array of animals, rabbits, octopuses, foxes, non-human primates, etc., engage in self-destructive behaviors, especially under conditions of captivity, that start looking, when you look at them for long enough, like suicide.
Yeah.
And so the paper builds a framework, a conceptual framework for making sense of those behaviors.
Right. Definitely a key area I wanted to get into, and we will in a moment or two, is animals in captivity. But I did find this thing I was looking for in Dr. Pierce's thing, where she says, although many people are quick to brush off the question, can animals commit suicide, as silly and fantastically anthropomorphic, we ought to stop and give the question some serious thought, as she does so, and others do too, who PhDs and other experts who have weighed in on your paper. But let me get a caller involved. There's a caller who's been holding for a bit, so I'd like to get someone else involved in the conversation as well. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. David Pena Guzman.
Yes, thank you for having another fantastic guest on this show. You know, one can look at the way humans treat animals, and Duncan just mentioned he's going to get into animal captivity, but having talked to the man who was involved in that incredible movie, The Cove, as well as someone who was a trainer for Winter, the dolphin, who is a dolphin that was rescued and is now basically trapped in a tank here in Florida, I've been, you know, told explicitly by people who know these marine mammals that they do get depressed because they're in captivity primarily, separated from their social culture, and that in one case, the man from the Cove, Rick O'Berry, I think is his name, actually believed that a dolphin just gave up on its life and died right in front of him. Now, if you look at what humans do to animals in general, vivisection, factory farming, let's put it this way. If the animals can't commit suicide, that adds to their horrible suffering. And what animal wouldn't want to end its own life if it could in the conditions that amount to torture and slavery? I will say one further thing. In our society, suicide is a taboo. Mercy killing is a taboo. Euthanasia is a taboo. We're not even allowed to euthanize ourselves at the end of our lives when we're suffering, but we are allowed to euthanize our pet. The whole issue makes no sense at all. And I thank you for recognizing that animals suffer, and sometimes they want to die. And I would say to you that most of the time they want to die is because of what we've done to them and their habitats.
All right, caller, thanks for that. Indeed, one of the things I was going to get into, and Dr. Pena Guzman, you can certainly address this because this is part of your paper as well. As the caller noted, in The Cove, Rick O'Berry does recall seeing a dolphin named Kathy, who he believes refused to take breaths, which in his telling was therefore committing suicide. And again, you have to know, I guess, fundamentally that dolphins, unlike us, choose to take breaths. That's not just automatic the way we do. So I don't know if there's anything else you'd want to say about that before we move on to some other elements as well.
Yeah, I think there are two things I can point out that are relevant in relation to this question. The first one is that we also know that animals do experience a number of negative emotions and psychopathologies, one of which is depression. But there are others. They experience chronic anxiety, they experience PTSD, and even antisocial borderline personality disorders, typically under conditions of confinement. And one of the things that I typically stress is that a lot of these emotional conditions or emotional states, whenever they happen in humans, the same phenomenon, they are almost universally recognized as antecedent or precursors or causes of suicide. And so when we begin to observe them in the animal kingdom, you already have reasons to suspect that possibly there might be room here for that discussion.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that, especially the case that Rick O'Berry mentions, I talk about it in the article. I discuss it at length. And Lori Marino, who is an expert on cetacean behavior and whom you've had on the show
mm-hmm.
in the past, she wrote a white paper in 2016 at the same time that I began thinking about this subject on dolphin suicide. And in this white paper, she documents evidence, the scientific reasons that we could have for believing that Kathy did, in fact, commit suicide. So, for example, she says, we know that dolphins are extremely smart individuals, very smart species with high-level social cognition that recognize themselves in the mirror. So we know that they have a sense of self. Secondly, we know that they have a very sophisticated neocortex with a particularly complex limbic system, which is the neural circuit associated with the processing of emotions, complex emotions, and memory. So we also have the cognitive power there. And finally, as you point out, Duncan, we know that dolphins are not automatic breathers. Each time they breathe, it's because they've made a decision, a voluntary decision, to take a breath. And so if at some point an animal, in this case a dolphin, reaches a point of suffering where it draws the conclusion, this isn't worth it anymore, we have the neural, the cognitive, the emotional capacity, and moreover, in this case, we have a very viable mechanism, which is that the dolphin can simply stop breathing and choose no longer to go up for air. But it is something that I discuss in the paper, this specific example.
And let me quickly follow up on the Laura Marino paper, which I haven't read. But in that paper, when she's writing, it sounds like primarily about dolphin suicide. Is she chiefly or even exclusively addressing dolphins in captivity or dolphins in the wild as well?
Well, there she is only talking about the science of dolphin cognition, the neuroscience of dolphin behavior, in order to lay out, how can I say this, in order to take down the notion that it would be impossible for a dolphin like Kathy to commit suicide. So it's just a description of their brain structures and about their emotional capacities, and also a description of their breathing, of their system of breathing.
Okay, because
it doesn't deal with any specific dolphin or any kind of dolphin.
I see. Okay, because much like our caller, I think when it comes to animals in captivity, and since we're talking about dolphins, I would say dolphins, I would say orcas, I would say elephants and others in particular, maybe that have, I think what we've now established is a much more sophisticated sense and a bit of sentience and all kinds of other things. To me, if I were an animal in some of those conditions in captivity, frankly, I might give serious thought to doing what I could to shuffle off this mortal coil. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to address at the moment about how being an animal held in captivity seems to perhaps at least alter the equation. Certainly there's no shortage of evidence of self-destructive and self-injurious behavior, especially with some of the animals that I've just mentioned and others as well.
Well, yes, I think that whenever you observe radical self-destructive behaviors, and they range from anything from self-biting all the way to things as intense as self-mutilation and auto-cannibalism, whenever you observe those in an animal whose mental health has been compromised by human-induced captivity, I think the discussion becomes an ethical one. It becomes a question of our moral to those animals to whom we have done this. And so one of the conclusions that I draw from the paper has to do with ethical theory. Do we have a moral obligation to change the way in which we treat animals if especially we realize that the conditions in which we keep them are bringing them to the point of self-annihilation, which is just such a high threshold to me that it seems to have pretty far-reaching moral implications, at least as I see it.
Yeah.
And so I do think that there is a correlation, and a number of people who have written about this piece have pointed this out, but there is a correlation between captivity and some of the psychopathologies that we observe in animals that lead potentially to suicide.
Right. Okay, Dr. Penny Guzman, we've got another caller holding, and I want to get a couple more questions. There's been all kinds of email, really interesting, some sort of too long probably to get into, some kind of a little bit off topic, but I appreciate all the email, and we have a few more minutes with Dr. Penny Guzman. So again, you can, this is, by the way, Dr. David Penny Guzman, assistant professor at San Francisco State University, and we're at the moment discussing the scholarly paper he wrote for the journal Animal Sentience, in which he addressed the question of whether animals can commit suicide. So again, in our final few moments, a conversation with him, but still you're welcome to join at 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Let's get that caller involved right now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. David Pena Guzman.
This is Craig.
Yeah, hi, Craig.
Hey, I know you're talking about that. Did you ever hear about like birds. I've got a green-winged macaw, and I've heard a lot about birds. When their owners pass away, the birds will pluck all their feathers out and commit suicide. Have you ever heard about that?
Yes. So there has been some research on bird welfare, especially on parrots. That's the one that I'm most familiar with, where in conditions of captivity, but also in cases where they seem to lose a loved one, they will pluck themselves systematically and almost compulsively until they bleed, and sometimes until they die. This is a phenomenon that's been well recorded, for example, in zoos and aviaries, but also people who have these birds as pets. They say that they're watching their animals do this, and it seems like such an irrational behavior that it seems to indicate a compromise mental health status.
Yeah. That people have told me, because sometimes my job is to travel. I have to travel around. And they tell me when I'm gone, my bird just is like not itself at all till I get back. And when I get back, he's all excited, you know. And I say he kind of goes through a depression when I leave. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was like factual or what. I've seen cases of it where people have died and they're like, even their little birds have, you know, like plucked themselves or died shortly after their owners.
This is well known, for example, in relation to dogs. Well, that when dogs lose a companion, that can be a human companion or another dog companion that lives with them, they get depressed, they mourn, and in some cases, they seem to be in denial about the death. So, for example, a number of veterinarians, and I talk about this in the paper, now actively recommend that if you have two and one of them die, you have to let the other animal see the dead body of its friend in order for it to process the death fully and is able to move on with its life. Because
I had three dogs and one of them passed away, and the other two dogs just roamed around, looking for the dog for like days.
Yeah,
and it seems that when animals don't have time to say goodbye, if an animal just disappears from their world, they don't know if that animal is dead, if it ran away, if it simply was transferred to another facility. But when they actually
need confirmation,
the body, what was that?
Correct. Like they need to have confirmation of the death of the dog, or they just need to be notified in a way, eh?
Correct. And recently, Duncan had Franz Duval on the show, and Franz Duval's latest book, Mama's Last Hug, opens up with this scene of a matriarch passing away. And one of the interesting things about that story is not only that the human caretakers, the researchers, said goodbye to Mama, this matriarch in the colony, but that they realized they had to let the other chimpanzees come in and say goodbye to her in order to process the death and to process the ramifications that her death would have on chimpanzee hires. So it's important to recognize that these are cases that indicate that animals have a sense of death, of what it means to die. And typically that's something that we have reserved only for human beings.
Yeah. Okay, Carla, we're going to just on our final moment or so with Dr. Penny Guzman, so we're going to thank you for your questions and comments and move on to our final moment here.
All right, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Bye. So Dr. Penny Guzman, there's so many things that reminded me of that we're sort of running out of time, but one of those things that when you note that the recommendation about having the dog see that his or her companion has passed away as part of their own sort of grieving and healing process, has that been shown to be true to the human side as well? Like if an owner or someone in the family dies, is that important to somehow see that for the same kind of process for the dog to go through?
Well, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any direct research on that question because it seems to be something difficult to control for. But there is research around the question of animals and death that bears on that subject. So, for example, I'll mention two things. We know that many animals experience something like bereavement. When a companion or a conspecific or a member of their social group die. I don't know that there has been extensive research on their bereavement when it's a human that dies. And the second thing is that there have been a number of scientific studies, and actually, I think it was National Geographic, just ran a piece about this with gorillas last month. about the way in which guerrillas process the death of a member of the troop. And so we have this data that suggests that animals can tell the difference between a living, a dying, and a dead animal. They can tell that difference. Not all animals, not always, but some animals. And once you put those pieces together and you insert them into the setting, for example, of a human-animal companionship relationship where there is a buildup of emotional bonds and care and trust, it's not inconceivable at all that an animal would be depressed about the death of the person with whom it shares its life. And so even though there is no direct research on that, on whether an animal gets depressed if a member of the human family dies, I think we have enough evidence to at least make a safe conjecture that that's probably true.
Yeah.
And it will depend on the kind of relationship that animal will have had to that member of the family.
Yeah. Well, gosh, there's just so much more to think about and discuss and to chew on here, but we have reached the end of our time. This has been Dr. David Pena Guzman, and again, the name of the article, if you want to search for it online, is Can Non-Human Animals Commit Suicide? The journal that it was published in was Animal Sentience. Dr. Pena Guzman, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
First, I want to, before we go any further, thank Elisa Priest, who pledged for the Cat Power ticket. So she's going to that show and supporting WMNF and Talking Animals in the process. So thank you so much, Elisa. In a few moments, I'll play back my interview with Selena Schultz, the precocious author and philanthropist. At 13, she's written a trilogy of books dealing with animal shelters, fostering, and adoption, and donated a serious chunk of change from the book sales to an array of shelters. We'll hear my interview with her in a moment. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner. This is Tim Harmston with a piece called Seagull on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I saw a seagull flying around in the sky. It was going around and around and around. I looked at it and I said, "Seagull, you could be anywhere in the world right now. Why are you in the parking lot at JCPenney's?" And then I thought, why am I in the parking lot at JCPenney's? And then I remembered Arnold Palmer casual wear. 50% off. You look like a jerk if you don't go.
That was Tim Harmston with a piece called Seagull, taken from his album The Most Bees Ever. Now it's time to hear my interview with Selena Schultz, who's already done more at 13 to help animals than many of us decades older end up accomplishing. I recorded this interview Monday afternoon. Speaking with her live really wouldn't work on this show because she's at school then. Here's my conversation with Selena Schultz on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals, Selena.
Thank you for having me.
When did you first realize you loved writing?
I think I realized it when I first started elementary school. I realized I kind of had a knack for it. I really enjoyed making up stories.
And so did you write beyond just the school stuff, like essays and assignments for schools? Did you start writing on your own just because you did like it and had a knack for it?
Yes, I did start doing that. I think my three books were the first big endeavor outside of school.
Yeah.
Now I frequently do short stories outside of school, too.
Oh, great. So I'm guessing you're probably someone who always loved reading.
Yes, I've been an avid reader from a very young age.
Yeah, no doubt. And then when did you become an animal lover?
I've always been an animal lover because I've had pets every year of my life. Ever since I was born, we've always had a dog, hamster, so I've always loved them.
Yeah. So what are the animals currently at the house there with you?
Currently I have two dogs, Cece and Snowy. They're both medium-sized. And I think that's it right now.
Okay. But it sounds like in the past there have been other animals, including hamsters and stuff. So it's been a few different.
We've had lots of small animals.
Yeah. And then you seem to have a real interest in animal shelters. How did that start?
Well, that began when I was 7. I went with my mom to the animal shelter, and I noticed the dogs weren't sleeping on any bed. Instead, they were sleeping on stacks of newspaper. Wow. And when I asked the shelter coordinator why this was happening, he said they were running really low on supplies, and they could barely afford to keep the dogs fed, let alone get them bed. So from then on, I wanted to do all I could to help.
Yeah, and what animal shelter was this?
This was SPCA Suncoast.
Okay. So that really bothered you, obviously, that they were sleeping in, on newspapers as opposed to beds.
Yeah, it struck me as really unfair for them.
So what did you do? What was your reaction at that point once you learned what the story was?
Well, my reaction was to collect donations for the animal shelter instead of presents for my 8th birthday, because that was right before I turned 8.
So then you were able to get some of those dogs' beds because of those donations?
Yes, I was able to. We got monetary donations and beds donated.
That's really great. You must have been very happy, and I'm sure the people at SPCA Suncoast were probably super excited, too.
Yes, they were.
So tell me how you did decide to write your first book.
Well, I decided to write my first book. It was after my 8th birthday. So it was planned to be a continuation of what I had done in collecting donations instead of presents.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote them to inspire other kids to do the same thing. I wanted to kind of pass that love of mine on with reading and animals and build them together into a book.
So, because, I mean, a lot of people would say, well, I'll just tell my friends to do this or see them at lunch or recess. But your idea was, instead of doing that, to like, hey, I'm going to write a book that really gets this message across. And I guess your idea was that that could reach more kids in more places than just your school or your neighborhood.
Yes, that was my idea, and it really worked.
Yeah, that's great. Did you find it hard? How hard was writing that first one?
Writing the first one wasn't too bad. I had already had the story in my head because they're all based off of true stories.
Okay.
So it's based off my personal life experiences.
Yeah.
It was just kind of getting the ball rolling, and my mom helped me self-publish it. So it was a good process, but it took a couple months.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's still pretty fast. And then how did that compare to working on the second and then ultimately the third book? Were you an old pro? By the time you got to the third one, were you like, hey, I know exactly how to do this and I can do it pretty well?
The second one was pretty good. I think they normally say that the second one's the hardest to write.
Yeah.
Which it was hard to get more ideas, but again, I had already had a story I wanted to base it off of. And the third one, I really had an inspiration because of my own pet, my guinea pig, because the third one is about how you can get more than just dogs and cats. You can get small animals. That one I was really passionate about, so that one came pretty easily for me.
I see. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, I haven't yet had a chance to read the book. Are they all kind of about shelters, animal shelters, pet adoption, those kinds of themes?
Yes. The first one's about adopting dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Second one is about fostering cats and working with your friends. And the third one's about how you can get more than just dogs and cats. You can get small animals.
That's great. That's covering a lot of good ground. And then what made you think, okay, I've written this book or these books, and I'm going to donate some of the proceeds from the book sales to animal shelters? Was that the idea kind of all along, or did that come to you at a certain point?
I believe that was the idea all along. That was why I started this.
Okay.
And now I have the organization that the umbrella for all these books, which is A Bed, A Buck, A Buddy.
Right.
So that is, A Bed stands for supplies, A Buck stands for monetary donations, and A Buddy stands for adopting or fostering or volunteering at the shelter. So because of that, I'm able to donate to different shelters because of my book sales.
That's great. Now, I know you said a moment ago that your mom helped you self-publish the first book, but if I'm not mistaken, are the books now available on, for example, Amazon and other places?
Yes, they are available on Amazon, and we do book events at different book fairs and animal events.
Yeah.
Where we sell them here at the table.
That's great. Is it still that even as you now sell them, still a certain amount of proceeds from whatever those sales are still go towards shelters?
Yes, definitely. There's a $10 donation for each one, and a portion of the proceeds will always go to shelters.
I see. And so I know a lot of the shelters from the list I think I saw on your website are Florida shelters, which of course makes sense. But I think I saw also one in the Caribbean, and then I think another one in Canada. How did you come up with those, or how did you know to include those in your list?
Well, I'm not sure about the Caribbean one, but we've also gone to New York and West Virginia and Canada. And those are normally when we go on vacation, I think, to carry this outside of Florida. And I have relatives there who can keep up with the shelters and how they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to help other places as well.
That's great. And do you keep kind of adding to the list, or do you want to keep it a certain size for now?
Oh, no, I love to keep adding to the different shelters and the money I donate to the shelters. I think I can always make a continuing impact.
Yeah, no, that's really great. And so you mentioned a moment ago, A Bed, A Buck, A Buddy. What would you say its purpose or its mission is now? Like, has that changed since you first created it over time?
I don't think so. I actually have the mission statement in front of me. It says, a Betta Buckle Buddy organization encourages children to help animals by donating supplies, money, or becoming a buddy to an animal at a local shelter. So that's when I was 8, and I still think that's the mission because I want to help children see that they can do and make a difference in their community, too.
Yeah. I think I saw somewhere that I think you and your parents are working on converting that into a nonprofit, what they call a 501c3. How might either the organization or its purpose or what it can do, how might that change once it is converted into a 501c3?
Well, I think we'll be able to donate more because the donations will be tax deductible off of people who donate. So I think we'll be more likely to get more input so we can output more to those communities that need it.
That's great. Okay, so just one more minute or so. Elena, if you can spend one more minute or two with me, I just have a quick question or two. So are you working on a new book?
No. So this trilogy is all wrapped up.
Okay.
But, however, I am working on a realistic fiction. I'm not sure if it's going to be a book, more of a short story, but I'm working on more realistic fiction now.
I see. Okay, so having completed the trilogy, you're kind of doing other kinds of writing, but not really continuing in the vein about adoption, shelters, that kind of thing. Is that right?
No, not with the book, but I'm still doing the book and selling them.
Right. No, I just mean that when you're writing new material or new stuff, it sounds like you're moving into a different kind of writing than you were when you were focusing on shelters and adoption and that kind of thing, fostering.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, so last question, I guess, for the moment is, do you know what you want to be when you grow up? I mean, you already are growing up, of course, already, but when you're an adult, do you kind of have an idea in mind of, like, what you'd like to do for your job?
Yes, I want to be a pilot, so I want to get my pilot's license and be able to do Pilots in Paws, which flies pets in different shelters across the country to get them to a forever home.
Okay, well, I guess we keep the theme going of helping animals no matter what, but the pilot thing sounds pretty cool and ambitious. Well, good for you. Well, Selena, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me on Talking Animals, and you're obviously doing a bunch of great work already, and it's just so nice that you're so committed to helping animals and shelters and continuing with those book sales. So maybe when people hear this, maybe they'll buy a few more books and we can help a few more animals along the way, too. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, my thanks again to Selena Schultz, who I'm pretty sure we will all be working for in just a few years' time. By the way, the website, if you want to find out more about her efforts, her books, etc., is abedabuckabuddy.com for Selena Schultz. Also want to let you know, too, that a few months back, I think we had a conversation with Brad Myers about what was then the first or one of the first vegan farmers markets that was going to be held at Safety Harbor Art and Music Center. Well, I guess it was very successful, so they're doing another one this Sunday, May 19th, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Again, at Safety Harbor Art and Music Center. So it'll be from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., a day full of music and vegan food and kids and face painting activities and cooking demonstration and apparel, art, jewelry, all kinds of stuff, eats galore, all kinds of vendors and stuff. So that's coming up again this Sunday at Safety Harbor Art and Music Center. We're reaching the tail end of Talking Animals for today. Rob Loya is up next with Radioactivity, extending this four-hour block of interviews, phone calls, and news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls Edition of It's the Music. So I will be back next Wednesday with another edition of Talking Animals. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. NPR News Headlines is coming up for 5 minutes, and then Rob Loya with Radioactivity. Thanks so much for listening. Take care. Bye-bye.